Have you noticed the leaves turning? I mean, really noticed them? There are more colors than seem possible, even on the same tree. Autumn leaves have always held a special beauty in my eyes. The reds and golds, yellows and oranges of autumn leaves are more vibrant and alive than precious jewels. Look at the leaves today. Really look. Find something you've never seen before. Find a beautiful leaf or two and press it in wax paper between the pages of a book. In the middle of winter, when everything is white and you long for color, take out your leaf and remember the day you found it. Remember the colors of autumn. Come, let us worship together. I've been having bad dreams this week about my father. I don't spend too much time anymore thinking about the past, but in preparing for this reflection, I've been remembering events that I haven't thought of in years. I tell myself that I am completely healed and have moved on, but I know that experiencing the horrors of abuse fundamentally changes who you are, and you are never the same. My mother, my brother, and I suffered abuse at the hand of my father for more than a decade. The abuse my father meted out ran the gamut, from emotional, mental, and physical, and back again. We never felt safe when he was around. It was like living in a minefield. One false move and it could set him off. When he was home and in a mood, the fear in the house was palpable. There would be days on end, however, when everything would be fine and we were lulled into a false sense of security. These pseudo-peaceful times never lasted, however. It would never take too long for the peace to be shattered by violence. And the violence was beyond comprehension. My mother felt the brunt of it in horrible fights that usually took place in the middle of the night when my father got home from the bar. I would be awakened by my mom's screams. The fear would rise in me so fast I would break out in a cold sweat. My brother and I would try to come to her aid, but it was of no use. Only when my father's rage had wrung itself out would the fighting cease. He would then pass out, and we were left to put the pieces of our shattered lives back together. The most amazing thing to me then was that in the morning he would have no idea of what had happened the night before. As an adult, I learned that he had blackouts from so much alcohol. But as a child, it just confused and angered me all the more that he didn't remember causing so much damage. By the time I reached my early teens, the hatred I felt for my father was immeasurable. Finally, when I was 14, my mother found the courage to leave and divorce my father. The day we left was one of the happiest days I could remember. For several years following the divorce, I had little or no contact with my father. He was still in the throes of alcoholism, and I wanted nothing to do with him. And then I had a child. My perspective on life changed. On one hand, looking at my tiny daughter, I could never imagine hurting her. On the other, something in me softened, and I wanted to reconcile with my dad so that he might be able to get to know his granddaughter. But, I couldn't let go of the past. I thought that if I forgave him, that it would make what he did somehow okay. That I would be excusing his behavior and betraying my mom, who by then had found a way to forgive, something I could not understand. Around this time, I started going to counseling for another, what I thought was unrelated, matter. But it turned out that all the rage and anger I was harboring had its source in the abuse of my childhood. I learned that forgiveness isn't about saying what someone did was okay. It's about letting go of anger, hate, and resentment so that other healthier emotions can grow and thrive. Forgiveness isn't about them. It's about you. I also learned to find compassion when it came to my dad. I am an extremely compassionate person, but as far as my dad was concerned, I had no compassion whatsoever. When I learned that my dad had seen and been subject to abuse in his childhood home, a light went on in my soul. I understood for the first time that my dad was coping with his life in the only way he really knew how. The old saying, "Children learn what they live," had never rung more true. For many, many years, my dad and I had a surface relationship. We never spoke of anything too painful, too sensitive, too meaningful. But recently, for whatever reason, maybe age, maybe life circumstance, we've become closer. He has confided in me and is proud to share his sobriety with me. My daughters, who vaguely know of my childhood horrors, can't put that together with the man they call their papa. For this, I am glad.
The reading is graphic, but it's not gratuitous, for it speaks a painful truth. It speaks a truth enshrouded in a silence so impenetrable that it can seem difficult to believe. We don't want to believe it. But the grim reality is that on the average, more than 3 women are murdered by their husbands and boyfriends every day in our country. Everyone denounces that horrible violence. No one makes any excuses. In murder, there's no room for ambiguity. But in a culturally influenced ambiguity is where domestic violence often begins. In the beginning, the possessiveness and jealousy can seem like love, the controlling behavior like real concern. Afterwards, he always apologizes, tells her he didn't mean to make her feel bad. He'll never do it again. And for a time, it seems like it's true. He's charming, considerate, affectionate. But then the tension begins to build. It seems like he's looking for a reason to snap, and she feels like she's walking on eggshells. Eventually, the eggshells break, and he does snap. This time, he grabs her arm to emphasize his point. It's uncomfortable, but it isn't like he hit her. She knows he didn't mean to hurt her, and soon enough he's telling her it is so. He's sorry, he'll make it up to her, and the cycle continues. An episode of abuse is followed by a time of remorse. A period of calm ensues until tension begins to build, leading ultimately to another episode of abuse. The cycle can be repeated many, many times in an abusive relationship, and the severity of the violence often escalates with the turning of the wheel. In speaking of the perpetrator this morning, I consciously used the pronoun he because most abusers are men and most victims are women. However, it is important to acknowledge that men can be and sometimes are victimized by their female partners, and that domestic violence also occurs in same-gender relationships. In fact, it can be especially difficult for heterosexual male victims to get help for fear that they will not be believed or that they will be ridiculed. And it can be especially difficult for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people to get help because of the reality of discrimination and misunderstanding about our relationships. Skilled social service providers like the people who work at Safer Futures and other shelters across the country understand this and are committed to helping all victims of domestic violence break free. They understand that identity and culture can pose unique challenges to which we must be especially sensitive. For example, women who live in rural communities need support in dealing with the isolation, lack of resources, and lack of transportation they may face. Immigrant and refugee women may have unique obstacles, including uncertain citizenship status and language and cultural barriers. Women with any kind of disability may face unique accessibility challenges. Teenagers have to deal with the realities of peer pressure as well as their uncertainties about what makes for a good relationship, what counts as healthy. And elderly abused women often face greater economic and physical dependence on their abusers, making them even more vulnerable. Every victim has her own story to tell. In listening to the stories, we have learned a lot about what domestic violence is, how it begins, how it progresses, and what it takes to break free. Domestic violence is not an isolated instance of violence in an intimate relationship. Rather, domestic violence is a pattern. It is a pattern of abusive behavior used to establish power and control over another person. The abusive behavior may be physical, but it may also be emotional, spiritual, sexual, economic, or psychological. It's important to linger here for a moment to understand this, because too often when we see portrayals of domestic violence, we see women with visible wounds and scars. That's part of the story, but so too are the scars and wounds that we cannot see. We can't see the places where demeaning words, intimidating gestures, and threatening comments are written on the body. We cannot see the scars that come from being isolated, from being prevented from getting a job or talking to family and friends. We cannot see the wounds that come when abusers use children or pets in an effort to frighten their partners and gain control. We cannot see the bruises to the spirit and the psyche that come when a man rapes his girlfriend or his wife. But just because we cannot see it, and just because we did not witness it, doesn't mean it isn't happening. Most often, domestic violence takes place in the privacy of the home. We can't tell by the size or style or value of the home whether domestic violence may be happening behind its doors. It is an equal opportunity phenomenon. People of all ages and abilities, all religious and ethnic and socioeconomic and educational backgrounds are affected. In fact, statistics show that in this country, 1 in 4 women and 1 in 9 men will be victims of domestic violence in their lifetimes. The sad truth is that domestic violence is not unusual, but all too common. In the beginning, victims often feel alone in their abuse, burdened by feelings of fear and shame. But as the people at the Faith Trust Institute say, it is not shameful to be a victim of domestic violence. What is shameful is when nobody helps. Our service today is intended to proclaim that ours is not a church in which we will be silent about the epidemic of violence affecting whole families. We will be informed about the dynamics of violence, and we will know that there are resources that can help. Resources like Safer Futures, where people who are abused can get help to heal, and resources where abusers can get help to cease the violence. We will be a church that will not perpetuate the legacy of shame that enshrouds too many religious institutions who keep silence on this issue. In this congregation, we will dare to speak about the unspeakable. Over the last few weeks, members of the Friends of the Congregation have been invited to create shirts in the spirit of the Clothesline Project. They're hanging up on the chancel this morning. Each one of these shirts represents the experience of someone in this congregation or the experience of their loved ones. I invite you, if you care to, after the service, to come take a closer look at them. I have been privileged to hear some of the stories of the people who made these shirts. And today, I will tell you my own. But before I do, I want you to know that I asked my mother's permission to share this with you, as her experience features prominently in my own understanding of my experience. One of my earliest memories is of my father hurting my mother. I was 3 years old, my sister an infant. My mother protected us, protected herself, by moving out of the little apartment we all shared. We moved in with my grandmother, and shortly thereafter, my parents were divorced, chalking the failure of their relationship up to their youth. My mother met my first stepfather a couple of years later. He had recently returned from the war in Vietnam and was struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. But my mother saw beyond his demons and followed him and her heart from her home in urban New York to his in rural West Virginia. It wasn't long before the violence began. I have vivid memories captured in the sounds of objects thrown against walls and so much shouting. My mother tried to protect us. One night she sent us to a neighbor's house while she waited out the worst of it. But it wasn't long before she had had enough. She had done this before, and so she made a plan to sneak away. He had the only car, so while he was out, my mother led my sister and me through the woods to the home of one of her friends. The friend was going to take us to the bus station where we were going to catch a bus back to New York to my grandmother's house. It didn't happen that way, though. My stepfather came home to find us gone and quickly put it all together. He met us at the friend's house, his hunting rifle resting across his lap. That night ended with my stepfather taking his own life. None of my mother's boyfriends stuck around long for the next few years. That is, until she met Chuck. My mother saw something in him that I could never see. She married him, and they were happy for a time. But I can't say that I was ever happy to have him around. I was on the edge around him, fearful especially of what he would say. It turned out that he was an alcoholic, and when he drank, his speech became even more sexualized, his body language even more threatening. I was 11 when he moved into our home, and I focused my energy on steering clear of the man. It wasn't until he was arrested 2 years later for sexual violence perpetrated against one of my sisters that I understood that I was never his intended victim. I learned well from these experiences. When I was 15, I had a boyfriend who tried to persuade me of his opinion by twisting my arm behind my back. I promptly broke up with him. Next, I had to deal with my boss at the grocery store where I worked throughout high school, a man over twice my age who routinely came on to me. It took me 2 years to find the courage, but I finally decided to tell one of the security guards about his harassment. I was advised to consider what I wore to work, to dress more discreetly, and then perhaps he'd leave me alone. I knew that that wasn't right. I knew that wasn't how it was supposed to be, but I didn't have the language to explain why. My first year in college, I took a women's studies class, and I found the language. There I was profoundly inspired by the women's movement I encountered in the pages of my textbook. I knew that I needed to be a part of that movement, for myself and for women around the world. Women around the world were victimized in so many ways, and I understood deeply that I needed to dedicate myself to the work for dignity, safety, and justice for women. That work, in theory and in practice, was the beginning of my healing. I was changed, strengthened, and transformed by my learning, but it couldn't completely heal me. Some wounds are deeper than learning. I said earlier that each victim has her own story to tell. So does each survivor. I am a survivor, and this is my story. With it, I have made a great deal of peace. Through my learning, but also through my activism in the women's movement, with the help of a good therapist and the support of understanding friends, and later, through my work as a domestic violence and sexual assault counselor and advocate, I found a way to healing. I can't say that I'm totally put together, that I'll never be troubled by my history again, but I can say that I am committed to dealing with my experience so that it does not stop me from living the life to which I am called. There is one more part of my healing journey which I haven't mentioned yet, and that is Unitarian Universalism. As a young adult, I knew at some level that I didn't quite have words for that part of my healing journey involved the healing of my spirit. I think ultimately that is why I began a spiritual quest as a young adult, which ultimately led me to our faith tradition. Unitarian Universalism helped me to save my life. Unitarian Universalism helped me to open up. I think I cried through nearly every worship service I attended for almost a year when I started going to church. In worship, I was open, touched, and blessed again and again. The people who sat next to me in the pews did not recoil in the presence of my emotion. They smiled at me, shook my hand, and told me I was welcome among them. They didn't know me, and I didn't know them, but I knew that we were traveling companions. I knew that we were each of us alone, and all of us together discovering how to be more human. And that, dear ones, is what I think we're doing at church. Each of us here is remembering, imagining, discovering, and practicing being more human, more fully alive. To be human, of course, is not always lovely. There is violence, hatred, suffering, cruelty, and indifference. There is pain, often more than we feel we can bear. But there is also tenderness, kindness, compassion, and empathy. There is joy, often more than we feel we can bear. Life breaks our hearts, and then if we let it, breaks them open even wider still. The work of spiritual maturity, in my opinion, is nothing more and nothing less than the work of learning to live everything. And so this morning, I celebrate the women and men who have found a way to keep on living everything, despite the reality of violence. Let us celebrate the children who have found a way to thrive despite the burden of trauma. Let us celebrate the people who devote their lives to the work of healing and the people who give themselves to the work of justice. This morning, let us hold in our prayers the ones who are victimized. May they find the support and the strength they need to hold on to hope. This morning, let us rejoice for the survivors who have found a way. May theirs be fullness and abundant love. And this morning, let us pray for ourselves, each one of us, that we will find and keep the courage it takes to live life whole. Amen, and blessed be.